Good morning. On Thursday, March 27th, here's the conversation. HPD no longer opposes the repeal of its exemption for certain sexual conduct in prostitution investigations, but questions linger. Today, criminal attorney Brooke Hart looks at the gray areas raised by the controversy. Meanwhile, 2,600 mental health professionals are meeting this week to assess new trends. We'll talk with Dr. Cerisi West-Olatunji about social trauma and how culture-centered mental health counseling is changing.
There's also a lot of change in the world of improv. Comedy teacher Mike Brown is back in town after a tour across the country, says improv isn't always funny, which isn't the case with Seussical the Musical, according to Kauai director Robert Carrasco. Making sure everyone performs better than Fox in Socks is another matter.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
Next, the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
The disasters that we hear about on the news sometimes leave us with a feeling of helplessness, yeah?
Well, for a lot of people, that would be true, or just knowing how they should respond or just dealing with the fact that they are responding.
Well, we certainly have enough of them that we keep hearing about, don't we?
Well, you know, it's true, and it may be trite to say that the world has grown smaller, but that emotional connection to events around the world, from the disappearance of Malaysian Flight 370 to the mudslide in Snohomish County, is anything but. How people far from events react is part of the focus of a gathering of 2,600 mental health professionals in Hawaii this week. Social trauma, grief, and culture-centered practices are all on the agenda. American Counseling Association President Dr. Cerisi West-Olatunji joins us now to look at some of those trends. Thank you for coming in this morning and making time for us.
Thank you for inviting me. Mahalo.
There is such a smallness about the world that technology has afforded us, and the reactions that we feel when we see despair, when we see disasters that are both natural and making and certainly terrorist in origin, can't be avoided for a lot of people. But how do we deal with that in a culturally sensitive way, given the fact that these people can be so far flung from the events themselves?
Yes, it is a very important issue to think about. How are we connected to these events that seem geographically very far away from us, but we're impacted? And so counselors definitely are trained to be able to do that. Our conference has really focused on that. So we have about 2,600 people who are in attendance here, but actually we serve about 55,000 counselors who are training to better serve people. Trauma is something that is of increasing concern to us. And so, for instance, one of the things that we're offering here is a demonstration series. So counselors can have the opportunity to see a demonstration of how to respond to, let's say, a campus shooting, of how to respond to a natural disaster, can see it in operation by trained professionals, and then have conversation about how they can implement that locally.
But we've had those disasters before. We've had horrible things happen, you know, going back to Columbine and well before that. It seems, though, that this would be something that they would already know? Or has it changed so much that you have to tweak it and show them something different?
There are some small changes that are significant for us as providers. One is the use of technology. So we know that people are using technology. I'll give you an example. Following the Hurricane Katrina disaster in the Gulf Coast region, a lot of people couldn't use their telephones, but they could text. And so they were getting information out using their telephones to communicate, to find people.
Their mobile phones.
Yes, their mobile phones. And so we can use that same technology to share information about how to cope following a disaster, to explain to people about how they might cognitively respond to a disaster, about the cognitive fugue that often happens that compromises their ability to make decisions, about their ability to even be in control of their bodies. And so we can provide that information to people immediately, almost instantaneously, if we know how to respond. What's different? We know that disasters are on the rise, both natural and human-made disasters. And so we need to be better prepared to not only be able to respond expediently, but also to use technology to be able to educate and also to orient and to provide interventions.
How would you rate the idea that, well, we know that we should be prepared, and we say that to people all the time, including making sure they have enough food and water at home in case a natural disaster would strike here or another type of disaster. And that seems to go onto the to-do list, but every day it gets a little lower and a little lower. But for your constituency, this, I would take it from what you've just said and how you are trying to push this agenda, seems to be that it's at the top of the list.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that we spend a lot of time on is advocacy for the profession. And we spend time lobbying on Capitol Hill to speak to policymakers. And I think that, you know, it's very human to not want to think about disasters. You know, who wants to think about something that isn't positive? So it's very difficult for us to think ahead to prepare for disasters. We also know that it's very labor intensive to train for disaster. So unfortunately, we have this juxtaposition. We don't want to think about it until it happens. And when it happens, we don't have the time to really train people to work effectively in communities. You know, I like what you've mentioned about culture and the relationship between culture and effective disaster response.
Well, when you were in Katrina, after the aftermath of Katrina, that was a very different experience than someone who might have been, you know, born and raised in, San Francisco might have felt, or any other place, coming there and not really understanding that people were having reactions not just to physically, oh my God, my house is gone, but the enormity of it in a very different way.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, for those of us who are participating in the conference, that you'll be able to see that there are many models of counseling following a disaster, following a crisis, that are being offered. And one of those models is culture-centered, the idea that we need to include and incorporate and honor the ways in which communities have historically responded to crises. What resources do they have to cope within their own context? Because we know that when we build upon their existing coping skills, that they're much more sustainable. We know that as we leave those communities, that people are more likely to continue to use those resources. Now, that's important primarily because what we understood after Hurricane Katrina is that our typical model, our historical model of disaster response, needs to be changed. Hurricane Katrina, the people in the Gulf Coast region were the largest group of people. It covered the largest landmass.
And now we have people who are all over the world who are very upset, still grieving over what happened with the investigation with the Malaysian flight, and knowing people, you know, it's not that far away for many, many folks. To be able to trace it back to someone or something that's involved with that. And certainly what's happening up in Snohomish County. What would you offer to those who are dealing with both sets of disasters?
That's a very good point that you brought up, and it's about how do we grieve, you know, the grief and loss process. We have a whole group of counselors who specialize in grief and loss counseling. So what is so different about perhaps a plane going down and people not being able to identify where are their loved ones? This complicates the grieving process for people.
But the fact that we have more grief and more disasters, or more disasters ergo more grief, means that this is going to be pretty much top of mind for a lot of the counselors that you're meeting with, all 2,600 of them, and 55,000 that you serve. Thanks so much for being with us this morning, and
thank
good luck
you
with
very
the conference.
Much. Mahalo.
Dr. Cerisi West Olatunji is president of the American Counseling Association. She's also professor and program director of the counseling program at the University of Cincinnati, where she leads the Center for Traumatic Stress Research. She and several thousand mental health professionals are in Hawaii this week for the ACA's annual conference at the Hawaii Convention Center.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:16. Coming up, improv that hits close to home, but first, a history of the elk in Hawaii.
Maybe you've been to this part of our backyard, the Elks Club in Waikiki. But what do you really know about it? The Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks Lodge now sits on a beautiful beachfront property. At the time the lodge was formed, it was the latest in a string of BPOE chapters that started with the fraternal group's initial creation in New York in 1867. After annexation, the BPOE made its way to Honolulu and gained popularity with unique and theatrical fundraisers and carnivals. The 1911 standing room only showcase of hula and geisha performances was a well-remembered example. The wife of prominent Honolulu businessman James Castle sold the Elks the tranquil 155,000 square foot property in the then countryside of Waikiki after her husband's passing in 1918, and this morning we're asking if you can tell us in what year the Elks Lodge was initiated. If you know, or have an elk in your family, we'll tell you. Post your answer on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. We'll give you our answer later in the show.
Good morning. I'm Bill Hummel from Hawaii Pacific University. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Over the past couple of years, we've had several opportunities to talk with members of Hawaii's thriving improv community, and it's clear that improv has come into its own. Locally and nationally, it's become a kind of performance art that doesn't always have to be funny. No community can thrive in isolation, though, and improv guru Mike Brown is back in Hawaii to share some of what he's learned touring the country. He's with us this morning.
Hey, well, thanks. I was about to say welcome, but
nobody
thank
ever
you for joining me today.
Nobody ever says welcome to me, Mike.
Chris, I'm so glad that you could join me here today.
I feel good
on my program, The Conversation.
I feel good about being able to share this with you. improv is moving beyond comedy. Fair to say?
Oh, 1,000% over. It's. One of the big things that one of our own gurus, Del Close, would say is that he would always talk about how he would much rather have a scene be interesting than funny if you can make it really about something. And I think that's kind of where the theater community is going nowadays. You walk into An audition for anything, a Broadway play, off-Broadway play, you know, television commercial, television show, movies, film, whatever. Casting directors and directors themselves are looking for people with improv experience. You know, can you read a script, internalize it, really know what it's about, and then be able to improvise from there? You know, what happens if you're live on stage in a Broadway show or off-Broadway show or whatever, and someone flubs their line? You know, are you going to be able to correct yourself? Can you pick yourself back up? So it's a marketable tool in the theater community as opposed to just, you know, comedy.
There's a great scene in that movie, The Dresser, where the King Lear is supposed to be on stage and he's late, mm-hmm. and they're all running around going, "Methinks the king cometh." You know, they're improvising in Shakespearean dialogue to cover that hole, right?
Exactly, yeah. And it's fun to see, and especially when it's done masterfully, people really pick up the pieces. You can't tell. You know, it's like a really good tailor. You know there's a seam there,
yeah,
but you can't really see the seam.
And that's true of just about anything that you're trying to do well, right?
Exactly. It's the concept of 10,000 hours. You know, you do anything for 10,000 hours, you become a master at it.
Well, how does an improv artist spend those 10,000 hours off stage?
I watch a lot of TV.
Uh-huh.
You know, if that's your craft, you really have to study it. As trite as it might be to say, television and film watching really is our medium. That's how you learn.
Sure.
You learn by watching other people. So, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, I'm doing my homework, and, you know, you're watching, you know, episodes of Breaking Bad or whatever, but,
I Love Lucy, yeah.
Of course. Oh, my goodness. I could spend hours talking about Lucy, but, yeah.
Well, those are the great comedians of past generations, people like Jack Benny,
mm-hmm.
have a real ongoing legacy, don't they?
Of course. They're never going to die.
Yeah.
Yeah. Groucho Marx, Harpo Marx is one of my all-time favorite comedians, Charlie Chaplin. You know, these were guys that they used vaudeville in improv. They improvised in their vaudeville acts to be able to refine and hone a routine and get it down the way they need it to be.
And the way you mentioned Harpo was clearly an improv artist, because the greatness of Harpo is that thing of, is he going to teeter right off the edge?
Mm-hmm.
You know, should there be kind of almost an element of danger? You're a little bit worried for the guy on stage. Is he going to be able to hold on to this bubble?
And I think that's the connection that I specifically have with Harpo, is that he is such a recluse, and you don't know, like, you don't know what he's going to do next. I love that feeling of danger. I love that feeling of you know, how is this going to fit in? How is it going to tie in? Is he going to go over the edge? And if he is, how is he going to bring it back? You know, at the end of the day, your scene work definitely has to make sense and relatable to your audience. And, you know, not everyone is as relatable to Harpo. You know, he's the id,
yeah.
To put it in Freudian terms.
The unfettered side of us, right?
Yeah.
No
yeah,
boundaries.
Just the pure, raw energy. You know, he was always after food, women, and music, I think. Not necessarily in that order, of course.
But to create that feeling of danger, to sort of bring it with you on stage, you've got to deal with things that you yourself are uneasy about, right? You've got to be afraid, in a sense.
Every single time I take the stage, I want to spill my guts.
Yeah.
You know, I get so terrified and so nervous. But as soon as I get on stage, it's just like all that melts away. And I specialize in a very specific type of improv, which is solo improv. And that is, I just wanted to go off the wall, just get as crazy as I can get. And it all started as a dare. Some friends of mine were walking down the street in New York. We're going to go to an open jam improv session. Someone says, hey, would any one of us consider doing a solo improv set by ourselves? And I said, of course, I'll try it. You know,
where you create characters that react to one another, right?
The way I create my scene work is that I do have multiple characters within the context of the same scene. Even though there's only one improviser portraying those characters.
Right.
Some people, I've seen other solo artists jump back and forth between characters line for line. I find that tends to be a little bit manic, and the audience can't relate to it as well. I like to just remain one character and talk to a phantom character
I see.
And whatever the phantom character says back to me. Now, now my job as an improviser is to react in a way that lets the audience know, hey, this is exactly what that other character said. So
your answers have to indicate that.
Exactly.
Kind of the Shelley Berman, Bob Newhart telephone routines, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's fun and it's silly and it's inventive. And in that type of medium, you can really play around with a lot of innuendo. You can play around with a lot of callbacks and just, you know, anything creative that, you know, that you can have fun with that you can't see. Anything that you can't see. I mean, that's why people love scary movies.
Sure.
Is because, like, the phantom character, you can't see it. You know, that's the scariest thing. Or in comedic terms, that's the funniest thing.
We want to be taken beyond where we are at the moment.
Heightened right? form of reality.
Yeah. We want some kind of... So exaggeration needs to be very much a part of what you do.
Heightening, exaggeration, repetition. And there's a structure, again, created by Del Close and Sharna Halpern from Second City, formerly Improv Olympic, now IO. But they created a form called the Herald. And so the Herald is built in a way that you specifically have to call back certain scenes. And in doing that, you can't just play the same scene over again. You have to find a way to heighten it and to make the stakes bigger and better. Because if they're not, it's just going to be, you know, repetition, same thing. Okay, we already saw that. Let's what else can you do?
It sounds like a really great field to be in, Mike. Thanks very much for coming on the show this morning.
Thank you so very much for having me. I really appreciate
it. That's good to have you. Mike Brown is a performance artist who studied at the People's Improv Theater and the Magnet Theater in New York, has taught improv at Oxford University, University of California at Berkeley, performing tomorrow night at the Ongking Arts Center in downtown Honolulu, and giving a workshop Saturday afternoon at the Loading Zone. To find out more, you can go on our website, hpr2.org.
If in the beginning there was water...
Well, if water is the essential ingredient for life, then a water supply is the essential ingredient for a civilization. And so we always look towards figuring out who has rights to water.
In the end, it will also be all about water, fighting for the right to those hydrogen and oxygen atoms. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
You count on HPR to be here for you 24/7, and we count on you and your financial support. Your early gift for Challenge 2014 signals your loyalty and willingness to help. We gratefully acknowledge Joan and Jerry Shapiro of Honolulu, Stan and Sharon Schutis of Kamuela, and Andrew McCullough and Angela Nishimoto of Honolulu. Thank you all for your early gifts for Challenge 2014. Make your early gift by midnight tonight, and you'll be part of HPR's Beijing Maybe Closer Than You Think sweepstakes, too. You can call us at 955-8821 during regular business hours to find out more, or click Donate Now at hpr2.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from First Insurance Company of Hawaii, providing auto insurance since 1911, committed to delivering personal attention and expert advice. First Insurance Company of Hawaii, FICOH.com.
The saga of the investigation into the Hawaii State Hospital continues. The Senate Judiciary Committee will meet today. Senators are expected to carry on their grilling of top hospital administrators about some of the same issues that led to a federal oversight in the 1990s. Chad Blair has another run at this conversation in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
I mean, this thing just obviously is going on and on and on, and who knows if it'll go on for 15 years, as we saw happen with federal oversight. But what is it that we know going into the hearing today that perhaps we didn't going into previous hearings?
Well, the people have been subpoenaed to testify, hospital administrators, state officials, so they will be under oath. So I imagine we are going to be hearing new information in Senator Clayton Hee and Josh Green's committee today. But what Nick Ruby does in the story that we have up right now is he takes a step back to look at what happened. You mentioned the federal consent decree that was in place for 15 years. You know, it was really in sad shape over there. There was puddles of urine on the floor, cockroaches in the kitchen. Patients were sharing toothbrushes. There were even, like, suicide hazards, exposed metal pipes, loose electrical cords. Now, we solved a lot of those problems, definitely related to hygiene and medication and use of constraints, but restraints rather. But it took $1 billion to do that, and we didn't fix everything. The problems now, the things that Hee and Green will be discussing today, is mismanagement, allegations of corruption, nepotism, and so forth. So we're expecting some new details to emerge.
So this isn't exactly like, as David Ezra said, Judge Ezra said, a scene from a 19th century insane asylum. I mean, to call it a horrible experience, but it seems that it has a new level of horrors given what you've just talked about.
It does. And Judge Ezra, of course, was the person who implemented the consent decree back in the day. Actually, maybe it's not an insane asylum for the 19th century, more like a Roman Colosseum. I mean, now we have patients that are actually beating up on the workers there. There are still staffing problems. So these are the kind of things that we're going to hope to come out today. Remember, the federal consent decree also asks that we have a community health plan to provide housing and treatment outside of the hospital. A lot of that stuff hasn't been taken care of. A lot of cuts to mental health programs during the Linda Lingle years.
And some who have said that the minute the consent decree, you know, was up and over, that that's when all the cuts began.
Right, exactly. So as Senator Hee said, don't want to have these problems again 5 years down the road.
Well, we can hope, at least, until we get down to the bottom of it and see if it's not happening. It just seems to be that cycle recapitulates itself. Maybe this time it won't. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Aloha! I'm Akumatu from Alaska. You're tuned in to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Tonight at 5, Beth Ann, you'll be bringing us Town Square. This is going to be an interesting one. This is the Pono choices that caused such a ruckus a couple months back.
Well, and still causing if you're... And we're going to talk about it tonight with the woman who was the principal investigator for creating Pono Choices. We'll also have some of the stakeholders from the community here. We've got Judith Clark, the executive director of Hawaii Youth Services Network. Also, Dr. Glenn Wasserman, who is the chief communicable disease and public health nursing division head at the state of Hawaii Department of Health. So they're going to talk about what the impacts are that they see, and then, of course, with Kelly Roberts, how this whole thing came to be in the first place.
Issue being what information is presented to teenagers about sex education and when, right?
When and what, and how we talk about that in a way that gives them the good information that hopefully keeps them safe in life. But a lot of parents were very concerned that, you know, they didn't get to see this. We even talked about it with Chad Blair, that he had to go sit down and he was told he had to take, you know, some sort of course to be able to understand all of this and why what was in the course was actually there. That caught a lot of people very, very angry, including some lawmakers.
Take a course to understand the course, yeah.
Well, tonight we're going to actually look at it and take your questions, too. So remember our number. It's 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We'll see you at 5 for Town Square. Continuing on now with another controversial issue in our news. In the last week, a part of a bill concerning criminal investigations of prostitution has filled the local and national dialogue. Why? Well, the idea that a current exemption in Hawaii law meant that law enforcement officers were having sex with prostitutes as part of their investigations. HPD said despite the law, it had internal policies in place, though they declined to tell us exactly what they were. They said they needed the exemption, and then yesterday they said they didn't. We called criminal attorney Brooke Hart to see what he makes of all this, and he joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth.
Thank you for being here. Good to talk to you again.
Very good to talk to you.
Well, when we talked to Teresa Bell over at HPD, the communication media liaison, she sent us back a note that had a line in it that was repeated in many different reports, saying that recent news reports claim that the Honolulu Police Department urged lawmakers to keep an exemption in state law that allows undercover officers to engage in sex with prostitutes. This statement is misleading and inaccurate. Was it?
Was it misleading? Well, unless you know the background, some people could see it as misleading. What's important to know are these facts. First of all, the undercover work by police officers, in my lengthy experience, has included going beyond mere words, and sometimes involves something close to, if not actual, penetration. I've had cases where the matter got to a point where the condom was on and the individual's body part was just about in, and sometimes in. Now, in the last few years, the police have moved more towards a words-only basis for arrests and testimony. This puts a premium on who can tell the story best and who can report what was actually said accurately. Now, if the police used tape recorders or some kind of a recording device and actually had the words so that you could capture for court an actual offer to agree or an agreement to engage in sexual contact in return for a fee, things would be a lot easier. But the notion that police should have a free rein to do more is really quite disturbing.
But the idea that this was, in fact, going on was not untrue.
Well, it does. Several criminal defense lawyers testified to that. In my own experience, it has gone on. Here's the problem. While the police claim that they have internal rules that prohibit it, and they probably do, they won't share them with the community.
And they certainly didn't share them with us.
They didn't share them with you or with anybody else. And the police have, on the other side, a rule that does not permit the public to know what it is that officers did who were disciplined, except if they were discharged or suspended for more than a year. So there's no way to get at the notion that there are these rules in place and what they are and how frequently police take advantage of them. After all, most police officers are honest, but in this particular area of enforcement, I have seen, shall we say, more parsimony with the truth than in almost any other area except perhaps narcotics.
You're really talking about potentials for abuses of power.
That is correct.
As we looked at some of what we were told, too, it seems to be that this idea of the verbal offer, being able to respond to that, being able to respond to a verbal officer from a suspected prostitute was at the heart of why HPD said they needed to maintain this exemption, which seemed a little bit illogical given the exemption allows them to go as far as you've just talked about. Was this a smokescreen?
I don't know what a smokescreen is, but I do know what the practice is on the street, and most cases these days are being made with words only, which leads to a particularly pernicious or potentially pernicious situation, the change in the law that permits extreme punishment for those who offer or agree to engage in sexual activity in return for a fee with a minor. And I'm not sure whether the 2 years age difference clause is going to survive, but just imagine this, you know, a a not very worldly college student from Hilo comes to UH, and one night he and his friends go down to Waikiki, and out are the undercover police officers, women who maybe are 21 or 22 or 23, but can pose and look like they're 16 or 17, and they tell the college student, well, you know, I'm really under 18, and the college student says, well, you don't look it. In any event, let's go over here in the shadows, and I'll give you $100 if you do so-and-so. That young person, who is otherwise not criminal and would never knowingly or intentionally have a sexual contact with somebody who's under 16, but for purposes of this law, it's under 18, taken into the situation, violates the law, and then the consequences are enormous. It's a felony. It's a felony for life because it can't be deferred, and you go on the sex offender registry. That, to me, is not a fair balance.
No, not for a kid who may be very naive and really be exposed to some of this for the first time, as you've just talked about. That also brings up another issue of who goes undercover. Are these people from HPD, or are they officers brought in from elsewhere? Because there seems to be this idea floating around that because we're a small place and people know people and have gone to school with each other, that the undercover cops have to be imported.
In my experience, they aren't imported, but there is a state Supreme Court decision which permits the police to use a civilian agent to gather the evidence and therefore often go further in the sexual activity than their internal rules might permit. And the Supreme Court in State v. Tooks upheld that behavior. I think probably importing officers is too expensive to do on a widespread scale.
Just to bring this to a close, because we have to say goodbye in a moment, HB 1926 is still very much alive, will be heard again on Friday, tomorrow. You expressed concern about the clause regarding minors. That seems to be where you're really hanging your hat on this one.
Well, it's one of the numerous concerns that I have about the bill. The bill takes from a procedure that we've used for more than 45 years, the deferral process for first offenders, and applies it to many, many cases that previously a deferral was possible, a deferral that allows a person to resurrect their life, to avoid the stigma of a felony conviction, and to go on to learn from their experience. In my long history as a criminal defense lawyer, in this particular area specifically, most people are not criminals. They're people who, on the moment, or maybe under the influence of alcohol or some other stimulant, decide to do something that's put in front of them by an attractive-looking undercover officer, and they've lost their judgment for a few moments. These are not cases that should result in sex offender registration, except for those who are actually looking for minors and attempting to make some contact that's clearly illegal. They're not people who prey on minors so much as they're just mistaken, and just being mistaken would not be a good basis on which to label a person for life.
And have their stupidity follow them forever.
Well, not just the stupidity, but the enormous cost. Getting a job when you have a felony conviction, and more so when you're on the sex offender registry, is all but impossible. And the collateral costs of this kind of legislation, we haven't even begun to think of.
All right, we have to leave it there for the moment. But Brooke Hart, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We'll talk to you again. Brooke Hart is a well-known Honolulu criminal defense attorney. He also teaches at the Richardson School of Law at the University of Hawaii Manoa in the Hawaii Innocence Project.
Today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you for the year that marked the initiation of the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks Lodge, the Elks Club in Honolulu. Judge Jerome Fisher, Grand Exalted Ruler of the BPOE, made a special voyage to Hawaii to preside at the opening of Honolulu Elks Lodge No. 616. That began a tradition of organizing Thanksgiving food basket programs, delivering necessities to needy families, and fundraising for selected scholarships. Starting in 1926, the Elks began working with Boy Scout troops and have found other ways to actively participate in the community. And it all started with the official initiation of that BPOE Lodge in April 1901. That's our backyard quiz for today, and if you have one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is Amanda Stone, and this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
One of the highest accomplishments for a creative artist, creating a self-contained world with characters and situations, crazy as they are, that somehow make sense. Few would argue that Dr. Seuss did just that with Horton the Elephant, the Cat in the Hat, and their many cohorts. A chance to translate that world into musical theater is a special challenge, and it's one the Kauai Performing Arts Company stands ready to take on with Seussical. Performances start a week from tomorrow under the direction of Robert Carrasco, who joins us by phone. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. I was thinking about this thing that Dr. Seuss created out of his own imagination, and it's a very complete little world that he's made, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. It's really crazy because it's like this completely wild and just out there kind of world, but it makes perfect sense to people, and of any age, too. Like, the lessons and things he talks about are pretty downright close to the heart for everybody. It's pretty amazing.
Maybe that's what it is that the craziness comes down to some very sort of sound, fundamental life stuff, huh?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you find when you read these books, there's a lot of very simple poetry. The prose is very very simple, just kind of a basic, easy rhyme scheme. But it's very much like, almost like how a kid views the world. And the simplicity of that, he's able to capture in making up words that make no sense normally, but in this world, in like a kid's imagination, make perfect sense. And it's pretty cool.
Well, you know, a lot of children's literature sort of works for that particular generation, but then seems stale as the years go by. That hasn't happened with Dr. Seuss, has it?
Definitely not. It's completely timeless. And I think that what you find, as I've been working on this show, is that when I talk to kids about it, they all, like the elementary schools here, like in Kekaha, for example, they all are like, whoa, we love Dr. Seuss. That's our favorite book. And I find I get that same reaction and have the same conversation with, you know, a 90-year-old grandmother,
yeah,
or a 60-year-old gentleman or whatever. You know, so I find it spans all ages, and everyone loves it the same.
What are the challenges of bringing that to life in a show? You know, everybody's got their expectations. Everybody read the books as a child. So how do you make that come alive for them?
Right. Well, I'm kind of a big little kid myself. Like, I still play video games. I'm a surfer. I skateboard, you know, pretty hardcore. And so I just, what it is this show, I actually approached it from the idea of, like, this show is literally a kid's imagination come to life.
Uh-huh.
And so all of the way that the actors are portraying their roles and stuff is to come across, like, from a kid's point of view. And the actual show centers around a kid named Jojo, who's imagining all this. And so, you know, we try to capture that in their body movements and in the way that they look at each other on stage and even the way that they sing, believe it or not.
So you have one character who's sort of a surrogate for the audience, and he encounters the Dr. Seuss. You encounter the Dr. Seuss characters through him.
Exactly. I mean, just to give you a sneak preview, which is totally fine.
Yeah.
You know, like, the show starts off with just a simple hat. You see the Cat in the Hat, you know, famous striped hat,
sure,
on stage. And a little boy just walking on stage, and he goes, sees the hat, and he goes, oh, what kind of a hat is that? I wonder what's under a hat such as that. And he just starts to make up things in his mind, and he dreams of the cat, and all of a sudden, boom, Cat in the Hat appears. And from there, a story unfolds into a fun, just epic adventure, if you will, on many different levels. And it's just really interesting how it happens. But it's all based upon a kid's simple imagination.
Just even that little line you quoted, that I wonder what's under the hat, he has a very distinctive cadence to all of his stuff, doesn't he?
Exactly. I find myself, since I've been so involved with the show these past few months, that I find that I'm doing that in my normal life. It's kind of funny.
Talking in Dr. Seuss pentameter, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-
talking to you on this show. I'm ready to talk, so here we go. You know, it's that kind of simple prose. You know, it just happens like that. And it's interesting, too, I got to say, if you don't mind, is that in the show is that it's mostly sung,
uh-huh.
right? I mean, it's almost an opera to a degree.
Really?
It's an operetta, technically.
Uh-huh.
But all the singing and all the dialogue follows that basic pattern. And it's all Dr. Seuss-style prose. So it's really interesting and can be a challenge, too, by the way. To you know, tell a story using made-up words by Dr. Seuss, and also using a prose or poetic pentameter, you know, to come across and deliver a story. It's actually a really big challenge.
Well, I would think that taking what's already existed in a words on a page form and translating it to music, you've got to it. The words impose a rhythm on the music that you have to obey, right?
Yeah, it very much so, and I believe that the authors really did a good job of capturing that. They have so many different kinds of rhythms and feelings of the music. Like there's gospel kind of feeling to it. There's blues kind of feelings. There's all these different kinds of like almost like Chicago-esque kind of feelings to it. Yet you're still able to use the same prose with the same kind of meter, and yet it feels completely different. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Yeah. And it makes sense in a Dr. Seuss kind of way, which is, but you sort of suspend your notion of what makes sense. That's the beauty of the whole Dr. Seuss world.
Exactly. I mean, there's a whole, one of the subplots is about the people going to war versus people that eat their bread butter side down.
Oh, yeah. That's a great Seuss story.
And so you just kind of go, huh? And they call them, you know, we will go to war against those bibulous butterside downers, you know? And what does bibulous mean? That means absolutely nothing. But in context, it actually makes perfect sense. You know, it's kind of like, ooh, that's kind of, so it's really fun.
Well, Robert, it sounds like great fun. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us this morning. Good luck with your show.
Yeah, definitely come to the show when you guys can. It's opening
We'll send people
Friday,
away, yeah.
And it's going to be an epic show. We have a super talented cast. They've been working really hard. We have an excellent orchestra. It's going to be outstanding.
I bet.
Very proud of these students.
Thanks, Robert. Robert Carrasco is the director of Seussical, which opens Friday, April 4th at the War Memorial Convention Hall in Lihue and runs for 2 weekends. You can get details at hpr2.org. Your first interview, Beth Ann, with Dr. West Olatunji, she used an interesting term about the way people react to trauma, which is cognitive fugue, the notion that there are several voices going on in your head, like the way different melodies interact in a fugue. All these voices are going on in your head at the same time, and you have to calm them down. That's an interesting notion.
I love that description, too, because of, you know, few among us haven't had that experience when something has happened, and all of a sudden these emotions and what you're hearing in your head is going off in a way that seems uncontrollable. But her whole point is we all need to be prepared to deal with this better, certainly those who are in the mental health profession.
And there are ways it can be done.
A lot of them, and they are refining many, many of them because of necessity. We've just seen so many natural disasters and issues of terrorism that this is now just a fact of our lives. That's going to do it for us for today. On tomorrow's agenda, we're going to have a chat with former Civil Beat editor John Temple.
And we'll be having a weekend celebration of the legacy of the Prince of the People.
Meanwhile, talk back to your radio where we can hear you on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or to me at BecauseHPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Let's meet up in the morning for more of The Conversation.